Hello there, and welcome to tonight's episode of Down to Sleep. This is the podcast of softly spoken stories to help you get a good night's rest. We just hit 300 episodes of this podcast on Patreon. That's 300 book readings that you can access right now at patreon.com/downtosleep. To celebrate, I'm doing an Ask Me Anything, so if you would like to ask me absolutely anything about myself, the podcast, behind the scenes, books, you can find the link to that currently at downtosleeppodcast.com or below this video. It's in my main collection of links. After tucking someone in 300 times, I thought it might be time to get to know each other a little bit better. It's also an opportunity for you to let me know a little bit about yourself. Anyway, find that form below this podcast. For now, let's tuck you in. Take a nice deep breath for me. And let's get down to sleep with Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll. For a minute or two, she stood looking at the house and wondering what to do next. When suddenly, a footman in livery came running out of the wood. She considered him to be a footman because he was in livery. Otherwise, judging by his face only, she would have called him a fish, and rapped loudly at the door with his knuckles. It was opened by another footman in livery, with a round face and large eyes like a frog. And both footmen, Alice noticed, had powdered hair that curled all over their heads. She felt very curious to know what it was all about, and crept a little way out of the wood to listen. The fish footman began by producing from under his arm a great letter, nearly as large as himself, and this he handed over to the other, saying in a solemn tone, "For the Duchess, an invitation from the Queen to play croquet." The frog footman repeated in the same solemn tone, only changing the order of the words a little, "From the Queen, an invitation for the Duchess to play croquet." Then they both bowed low, and their curls got entangled together. Alice laughed so much at this that she had to run back into the wood for fear of their hearing her, and when she next peeped out, the fish footman was gone, and the other was sitting on the ground near the door, staring stupidly up into the sky. Alice went timidly up to the door and knocked. "There's no sort of use in knocking," said the footman, "and that for two reasons. First, because I'm on the same side of the door as you are. Secondly, because they're making such a noise inside, no one could possibly hear you." And certainly there was a most extraordinary noise going on within. A constant howling and sneezing, and every now and then a great crash, as if a dish or kettle had been broken to pieces. "Please then," said Alice, "how am I to get in?"
"There might be some sense in your knocking," the footman went on without attending to her. "If we had the door between us, for instance, if you were inside, you might knock, and I could let you out, you know." He was looking up into the sky all the time that he was speaking, and this, Alice thought, decidedly uncivil.
"But perhaps he can't help it," she said to herself. "His eyes are so very nearly at the top of his head. But at any rate, he might answer questions." "How am I to get in?" she repeated aloud.
"I shall sit here," the footman remarked, "till tomorrow."
At this moment, the door of the house opened, and a large plate came skimming out, straight at the footman's head. It just grazed his nose, and broke to pieces against one of the trees behind him.
"Or next day, maybe," the footman continued in the same tone, exactly as if nothing had happened.
"How am I to get in?" asked Alice again, in a louder tone.
"Are you to get in at all?" said the footman. "That's the first question, you know."
It was, no doubt, only Alice did not like to be told so. "It's really dreadful," she muttered to herself. "The way all the creatures argue,
It's enough to drive one crazy. The footman seemed to think this a good opportunity for repeating his remark, with variations.
I shall sit here, he said, on and off for days and days.
But what am I to do? Said Alice.
Anything you like, said the footman, and began whistling.
Oh, there's no use in talking to him, said Alice desperately. He's perfectly idiotic.
And she opened the door and went in. The door led right into a large kitchen, which was full of smoke from one end to the other. The Duchess was sitting on a three-legged stool in the middle, nursing a baby. The cook was leaning over the fire, stirring a large cauldron which seemed to be full of soup.
There's certainly too much pepper in that soup, Alice said to herself, as well as she could for sneezing. There was certainly too much of it in the air. Even the Duchess sneezed occasionally. And as for the baby, it was sneezing and howling alternately, without a moment's pause. The only things in the kitchen that did not sneeze were the cook and a large cat which was sitting on the hearth and grinning from ear to ear.
Please, would you tell me, said Alice, a little timidly, for she was not quite sure whether it was good manners for her to speak first.
Why your cat grins like that?
It's a Cheshire cat, said the Duchess, and that's why, pig. She said the last word with such sudden violence that Alice quite jumped, but she saw in another moment that it was addressed to the baby and not to her, so she took courage and went on again.
I didn't know that Cheshire cats always grinned. In fact, I didn't know that cats could grin.
They all can, said the Duchess, and most of them do.
I don't know of any that do, Alice said very politely, feeling quite pleased to have got into a conversation.
You don't know much, said the Duchess, and that's a fact.
Alice did not at all like the tone of this remark, and thought it would be as well to introduce some other subject of conversation. While she was trying to fix on one, the cook took the cauldron of soup off the fire, and at once set to work throwing everything within her reach at the Duchess and the baby. The fire irons came first, then followed a shower of saucepans, plates, and dishes. The Duchess took no notice of them, even when they hit her, and the baby was howling so much already that it was quite impossible to say whether the blows hurt it or not.
"Oh, please mind what you're doing," cried Alice, jumping up and down in an agony of terror.
"Oh, there goes his precious nose," as an unusually large saucepan flew close by it and very nearly carried it off.
"If everybody minded their own business," the Duchess said in a hoarse growl, "the world would go round a deal faster than it does."
"Which would not be an advantage," said Alice, who felt very glad to get an opportunity of showing off a little of her knowledge.
"Just think of what work it would make with the day and night. You see, the earth takes 24 hours to turn round on its axis, and—"
"Talking of axes," said the Duchess,
"chop off her head."
Alice glanced rather anxiously at the cook, to see if she meant to take the hint. But the cook was busily stirring the soup, and seemed not to be listening. So she went on again.
24 hours, I think, or is it 12?
"Oh, don't bother me," said the Duchess.
"I never could abide figures."
And with that, she began nursing her child again, singing a sort of lullaby to it as she did so, and giving it a violent shake at the end of every line.
"Speak roughly to your little boy, and beat him when he sneezes. He only does it to annoy, because he knows it teases."
A chorus, in which the cook and the baby joined, "Wow, wow, wow." While the Duchess sang the second verse of the song, she kept tossing the baby violently up and down, and the poor little thing howled so that Alice could hardly hear the words. I speak severely to my boy. I beat him when he sneezes, for he can thoroughly enjoy the pepper when he pleases. Wow, wow, wow.
Here, you may nurse it a bit if you like, the Duchess said to Alice, flinging the baby at her as she spoke. I must go and get ready to play croquet with the Queen.
And she hurried out of the room. The cook threw a frying pan after her as she went out, but it just missed her. Alice caught the baby with some difficulty, as it was a queer-shaped little creature, and held out its arms and legs in all directions. Just like a starfish, thought Alice. The poor little thing was snorting like a steam engine when she caught it, and kept doubling itself up and straightening itself out again. So that altogether, for the first minute or two, it was as much as she could do to hold it. As soon as she had made out the proper way of nursing it, which was to twist it up into a sort of knot, and then keep tight hold of its rear ear and left foot so as to prevent it undoing itself, she carried it out into the open air. If I don't take this child away with me, thought Alice, they're sure to kill it in a day or two. Wouldn't it be murder to leave it behind? She said the last words out loud, and the little thing grunted in reply. It had left off sneezing by this time.
Don't grunt, said Alice. That's not at all the proper way of expressing yourself.
The baby grunted again, and Alice looked very anxiously into its face to see what was the matter with it. There could be no doubt that it had a very turn-up nose, much more like a snout than a real nose. Also, its eyes were extremely small for a baby. Altogether, Alice did not like the look of the thing at all. But perhaps it was only sobbing, she thought, and looked into its eyes again to see if there were any tears. No, there were no tears. If you're going to turn into a pig, my dear, said Alice, I'll have nothing more to do with you. Mind now. The poor little thing sobbed again, or grunted. It was impossible to say which. And they went on for some while in silence. Alice was just beginning to think to herself, now what am I going to do with this creature when I get home? When it grunted again, so violently that she looked down into its face in some alarm. This time there could be no mistake about it. It was neither more nor less than a pig, and she felt that it would be quite absurd for her to carry it further. So she set the little creature down and felt quite relieved to see it trot away quietly into the wood. If it had grown up, she said to herself, it would have made a dreadfully ugly child, but it makes a rather handsome pig, I think. And she began thinking over other children she knew, who might do very well as pigs, and was just saying to herself, if one only knew the right way to change them, when she was a little startled by seeing the Cheshire Cat sitting on a bough of a tree a few yards off. The cat only grinned when it saw Alice. It looked good-natured, she thought. Still, it had very long claws and a great many teeth, so she felt that it ought to be treated with respect. Cheshire Puss, she began rather timidly. She did not know at all whether it would like the name. However, it only grinned a little wider. Come, it's pleased so far, thought Alice, and she went on. Would you tell me, please, which way I ought to go from here? That depends a good deal on where you want to get to, said the cat. I don't much care where, said Alice. Then it doesn't matter which way you go, said the cat. So long as I get somewhere, Alice added as an explanation. Oh, you're sure to do that, said the cat. If you only walk long enough. Alice felt that this could not be denied, so she tried another question. What sort of people live about here? "In that direction," the cat said, waving its right paw around, "lives a hatter. And in that direction," waving the other paw, "lives a March Hare. Visit either you like. They're both mad."
"But I don't want to go among mad people," Alice remarked.
"Oh, you can't help that," said the cat. "We're all mad here. I'm mad. You're mad."
"How do you know I'm mad?" said Alice.
"You must be," said the cat, "or you wouldn't have come here."
Alice didn't think that proved it at all. However, she went on. "And how do you know that you're mad?"
"To begin with," said the cat, "a dog's not mad, you grant that?"
"I suppose so," said Alice.
"Well then," the cat went on, "you see, a dog growls when it's angry, and wags its tail when it's pleased. Now I growl when I'm pleased, and wag my tail when I'm angry. Therefore, I'm mad."
"I call it purring, not growling," said Alice.
"Call it what you like," said the cat.
"Do you play croquet with the Queen today?"
"I should like it very much," said Alice, "but I haven't been invited yet."
"You'll see me there," said the cat, and vanished.
Alice was not much surprised at this. She was getting so used to queer things happening. While she was looking at the place where it had been, it suddenly appeared again.
"By the by, what became of the baby?" said the cat. "I'd nearly forgotten to ask."
"It turned into a pig," Alice quietly said, just as if it had come back in a natural way.
"I thought it would," said the cat, and vanished again.
Alice waited a little, half expecting to see it again, but it did not appear, and after a minute or two, she walked on in the direction in which the March Hare was said to live.
"I've seen hatters before," she said to herself. "The March Hare will be much the most interesting. And perhaps as this is May, it won't be raving mad. At least not so mad as it was in March." As she said this, she looked up, and there was the cat again, sitting on a branch of a tree.
"Did you say pig or fig?" said the cat.
"I said pig," replied Alice.
"And I wish you wouldn't keep appearing and vanishing so suddenly. You make one quite giddy."
"All right," said the cat. And this time it vanished quite slowly, beginning with the end of the tail and ending with the grin, which remained some time after the rest of it had gone.
"Well, I've often seen a cat without a grin," thought Alice. "But a grin without a cat, it's the most curious thing I ever saw in my life."
She had not gone much farther before she came in sight of the house of the March Hare. She thought it must be the right house, because the chimneys were shaped like ears, and the roof was thatched with fur. It was so large a house that she did not like to go nearer till she had nibbled some more of the left-hand bit of mushroom, and raised herself to about 2 feet high. Even then, she walked up towards it rather timidly, saying to herself, "Suppose it should be raving mad after all. I almost wish I'd gone to see the Hatter instead." There was a table set out under a tree in front of the house, and the March Hare and the Hatter were having tea at it. A dormouse was sitting between them, fast asleep, and the other two were using it as a cushion, resting their elbows on it and talking over its head. "Very uncomfortable for the dormouse," thought Alice. "Only, as it's asleep, I suppose it doesn't mind." The table was a large one, but the three were all crowded together at one corner of it.
"No room, no room," they cried out when they saw Alice coming.
"There's plenty of room,"
said Alice indignantly, and she sat down in a large armchair at one end of the table. "Have some wine," the March Hare said in an encouraging tone. Alice looked all round the table, but there was nothing on it but tea. "I don't see any wine," she remarked. "There isn't any," said the March Hare. "Then it wasn't very civil of you to offer it," said Alice angrily. "It wasn't very civil of you to sit down without being invited," said the March Hare. "I didn't know it was your table," said Alice. "It's laid for a great many more than three." "Your hair wants cutting," said the Hatter. He'd been looking at Alice for some time with great curiosity, and this was his first speech. "You should learn not to make personal remarks," Alice said with some severity. "It's very rude." The Hatter opened his eyes very wide on hearing this, but all he said was, "Why is a raven like a writing desk?" "Come, we shall have some fun now," thought Alice. "I'm glad they've begun asking riddles. I believe I can guess that," she added aloud. "Do you mean you think you can find out the answer to it?" said the March Hare. "Exactly so," said Alice. "Then you should say what you mean," the March Hare went on. "I do," Alice hastily replied. "At least, I mean what I say. That's the same thing, you know." "Not the same thing a bit," said the Hatter. "You might just as well say that I see what I eat is the same thing as I eat what I see." "You might just as well say," added the March Hare, "that I like what I get is the same thing as I get what I like." "You might just as well say," added the Dormouse, who seemed to be talking in his sleep, "that I breathe when I sleep is the same thing as I sleep when I breathe." "It is the same thing with you," said the Hatter, and here the conversation dropped, and the party sat silent for a minute, while Alice thought over all she could remember about ravens and writing desks, which wasn't much. The Hatter was the first to break the silence. "What day of the month is it?" he said, turning to Alice. He had taken his watch out of his pocket and was looking at it uneasily, shaking it every now and then and holding it to his ear. Alice considered a little and then said, "The 4th. 2 days wrong," sighed the Hatter. "I told you butter wouldn't suit the works," he added, looking angrily at the March Hare. "It was the best butter," the March Hare meekly replied. "Yes, but some crumbs must have got in as well," the Hatter grumbled. "You shouldn't have put it in with the bread knife." The March Hare took the watch and looked at it gloomily. Then he dipped it into his cup of tea and looked at it again. But he could think of nothing better to say than his first remark. "It was the best butter, you know." Alice had been looking over his shoulder with some curiosity. "What a funny watch," she remarked. "It tells the day of the month and doesn't tell what o'clock it is." "Why should it?" muttered the Hatter. "Does your watch tell you what year it is?" "Of course not," Alice replied very readily. "But that's because it stays the same year for such a long time altogether." "Which is just the case with mine," said the Hatter. Alice felt dreadfully puzzled. The Hatter's remark seemed to have no sort of meaning in it, and yet it was certainly English. "I don't quite understand you," she said, as politely as she could. "The Dormouse is asleep again," said the Hatter, and he poured a little hot tea upon its nose. The Dormouse shook its head impatiently, and said, without opening its eyes, "Of course, of course. Just what I was going to remark myself." "Have you guessed the riddle yet?"
the Hatter said, turning to Alice again.
No, I give it up, Alice replied. What's the answer?
I haven't the slightest idea, said the Hatter.
Nor I, said the March Hare.
Alice sighed wearily.
I think you might do something better with the time, she said, than waste it in asking riddles that have no answers.
If you knew time as well as I do, said the Hatter, you wouldn't talk about wasting it.
It's him.
I don't know what you mean, said Alice.
Of course you don't, the Hatter said,
tossing his head contemptuously.
I dare say you never even spoke to time.
Perhaps not, Alice cautiously replied. But I know I have to beat time when I learn music.
Ah, that accounts for it, said the Hatter.
He won't stand beating. Now, if you only kept on good terms with him, he'd do almost anything you liked with the clock. For instance, suppose it were 9 o'clock in the morning, just in time to begin lessons. You'd only have to whisper a hint to time, and round goes the clock in a twinkling. 1:30, time for dinner.
I only wish it was, the March Hare said to itself in a whisper.
That would be grand, certainly, said Alice thoughtfully. But then I shouldn't be hungry for it, you know.
Not at first, perhaps, said the Hatter. But you could keep it to 1:30 as long as you liked.
Is that the way you manage? Alice asked.
The Hatter shook his head mournfully.
Not I, he replied.
We quarrelled last March, just before he went mad, you know, pointing with his teaspoon at the March Hare. It was at the great concert given by the Queen of Hearts, and I had to sing.
Twinkle, twinkle, little bat, how I wonder what you're at. You know the song, perhaps.
I've heard something like it, said Alice.
It goes on, you know, the Hatter continued, in this way.
Up above the world you fly, like a tea tray in the sky. Twinkle, twinkle.
Here the Dormouse shook itself and began singing in its sleep.
Twinkle, 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 twinkle.
And went on so long, they had to pinch it to make it stop.
Well, I had hardly finished the first verse, said the Hatter, when the Queen jumped up and bawled out, he is murdering the time off with his head.
How dreadfully savage, exclaimed Alice.
And ever since that, the Hatter went on in a mournful tone, he won't do a thing, I ask. It's always 6 o'clock now.
A bright idea came into Alice's head.
Is that the reason so many things are put out here? She asked.
Yes, that's it, said the Hatter with a sigh.
It's always tea time, and we've no time to wash the things between whiles.
Then you keep moving round, I suppose, said Alice.
Exactly so, said the Hatter, as the things get used up.
But what happens when you come to the beginning again? Alice ventured to ask.
Oh, suppose we change the subject, the March Hare interrupted, yawning.
I'm getting tired of this. I vote the young lady tells us a story.
I'm afraid I don't know one, said Alice, rather alarmed at the proposal.
Then the Dormouse shall, they both cried. Wake up, Dormouse! And they pinched it on both sides at once.
The Dormouse slowly opened his eyes. I wasn't asleep, he said in a hoarse, feeble voice. I heard every word you fellows were saying.
Tell us a story, said the March Hare.
Yes, please do, pleaded Alice.
And be quick about it, added the Hatter,
or you'll be asleep again before it's done.
Once upon a time, there were 3 little sisters,
the Dormouse began in a great hurry. "And their names were Elsie, Lacey, and Tilly. And they lived at the bottom of a well." "What did they live on?" said Alice, who always took a great interest in questions of eating and drinking. "They lived on treacle," said the Dormouse, after thinking a minute or two. "They couldn't have done that, you know," Alice gently remarked. "They'd have been ill." "So they were," said the Dormouse. "Very ill." Alice tried to fancy to herself what such an extraordinary ways of living would be like, but it puzzled her too much, so she went on. "But why did they live at the bottom of a well?" "Take some more tea," the March Hare said to Alice very earnestly. "I've had nothing yet," Alice replied in an offended tone, "so I can't take more."
"You mean you can't take less," said the Hatter. "It's very easy to take more than nothing."
"Nobody asked your opinion," said Alice.
"Who's making personal remarks now?" the Hatter asked triumphantly.
Alice did not quite know what to say to this, so she helped herself to some tea and bread and butter, and then turned to the Dormouse and repeated her question. "Why did they live at the bottom of a well?" The Dormouse again took a minute or two to think about it and then said,
"It was a treacle well."
"There's no such thing," Alice was beginning very angrily, but the Hatter and the March Hare went, "Shh, shh," and the Dormouse sulkily remarked,
"If you can't be civil, you'd better finish the story for yourself."
"No, please go on," Alice said very humbly. "I won't interrupt again. I dare say there may be one."
"One, indeed," said the Dormouse indignantly.
However, he consented to go on.
"And so these three little sisters, they were learning to draw, you know."
"What did they draw?" said Alice, quite forgetting her promise.
"Treacle," said the Dormouse, without considering at all this time.
"I want a clean cup," interrupted the Hatter. "Let's all move one place on." He moved on as he spoke, and the Dormouse followed him. The March Hare moved into the Dormouse's place, and Alice rather unwillingly took the place of the March Hare. The Hatter was the only one who got any advantage from the change, and Alice was a good deal worse off than before, as the March Hare had just upset the milk jug into his plate. Alice did not wish to offend the Dormouse again, so she began very cautiously.
"But I don't understand. Where did they draw the treacle from?"
"You can draw water out of a water well," said the Hatter. "So I think you could draw treacle out of a treacle well, eh, stupid?"
"But they were in the well," Alice said to the Dormouse, not choosing to notice this last remark. "Of course they were," said the Dormouse. "Well in."
This answer so confused poor Alice that she let the Dormouse go on for some time without interrupting it.
"They were learning to draw," the Dormouse went on, yawning and rubbing its eyes, for it was getting very sleepy. "They drew all manner of things. Everything that begins with an M."
"Why with an M?" said Alice.
"Why not?" said the March Hare.
Alice was silent. The Dormouse had closed its eyes by this time and was going off into a doze. But on being pinched by the Hatter, it woke up again with a little shriek and went on.
"That begins with an M, such as mousetraps, and the moon, and memory, and muchness. You know, you say things are much of a muchness. Did you ever see a thing as a drawing of a muchness?"
"Really, now you ask me," said Alice, very much confused. "I don't think..."
Then you shouldn't talk, said the Hatter. This piece of rudeness was more than Alice could bear. She got up in great disgust and walked off. The Dormouse fell asleep instantly, and neither of the others took the least notice of her going, though she looked back once or twice, half hoping that they would call after her. The last time she saw them, they were trying to put the Dormouse into the teapot.
At any rate, I'll never go there again, said Alice, as she picked her way through the wood. It's the stupidest tea party I ever was at in all my life.
Just as she said this, she noticed that one of the trees had a door leading right into it.
That's very curious, she thought. But everything's curious today. I think I may as well go in at once.
And in she went. Once more she found herself in the long hall and close to the little glass table.
Now, I'll manage better this time, she said to herself,
and began by taking the little golden key and unlocking the door that led into the garden. Then she went to work nibbling at the mushroom. She had kept a piece of it in her pocket, till she was about a foot high. Then she walked down the little passage, and then she found herself at last in the beautiful garden, among the bright flower beds and the cool fountains. A large rose tree stood near the entrance of the garden. The roses growing on it were white, but there were three gardeners at it, busily painting them red. Alice thought this a very curious thing, and she went nearer to watch them. And just as she came up to them, she heard one of them say, "Look out now, Five. Don't go splashing paint over me like that." "Oh, I couldn't help it," said Five in a sulky tone. "Seven jogged my elbow." On which Seven looked up and said, "That's right, Five. Always lay the blame on others."
"You'd better not talk," said Five.
"I heard the Queen say only yesterday you deserved to be beheaded."
"What for?" said the one who had spoken first.
"That's none of your business, Two," said Seven.
"Yes, it is his business," said Five.
"And I'll tell him. It was for bringing the cook tulip roots instead of onions."
Seven flung down his brush and had just begun,
"Well, of all the unjust things,"
when his eye chanced to fall upon Alice, as she stood watching them, and he checked himself suddenly. The others looked round also, and all of them bowed low.
"Would you tell me," said Alice, a little timidly, "why you're painting those roses?"
Five and Seven said nothing but looked at Two. Two began in a low voice,
"Why, the fact is, you see, miss, this here ought to have been a red rose tree, and we put a white one in by mistake. And if the Queen was to find out, we should all have our heads cut off, you know? So you see, miss, we're doing our best before she comes to..."
At this moment, Five, who had been anxiously looking across the garden, called out,
"The Queen! The Queen!"
And the three gardeners instantly threw themselves flat upon their faces. There was a sound of many footsteps, and Alice looked round, eager to see the Queen. First came 10 soldiers carrying clubs. These were all shaped like the three gardeners, oblong and flat, with their hands and feet at the corners. Next, the 10 courtiers. These were ornamented all over with diamonds and walked two and two as the soldiers did. After these came the royal children. There were 10 of them, and the little dears came jumping merrily along hand in hand in couples. They were ornamented with hearts. Next came the guests, mostly kings and queens, and among them Alice recognized the white rabbit. It was talking in a hurried, nervous manner, smiling at everything that was said. and went by without noticing her. Then followed the Knave of Hearts, carrying the King's crown on a crimson velvet cushion. And last of all, this grand procession, came the King and Queen of Hearts. Alice was rather doubtful whether she ought not to lie down on her face like the three gardeners, but she could not remember ever having heard of such a rule at processions. And besides, what would be the use of a procession, thought she, if people had to all lie down upon their faces so they couldn't see it? So she stood still where she was and waited. When the procession came opposite to Alice, they all stopped and looked at her, and the Queen said severely, "Who is this?" She said it to the Knave of Hearts, who only bowed and smiled in reply. "Idiot," said the Queen, tossing her head impatiently. And, turning to Alice, she went on, "What's your name, child?"
"My name is Alice, so please your Majesty," said Alice very politely. But she added to herself, "Why, they're only a pack of cards after all. I needn't be afraid of them."
"And who are these?" said the Queen, pointing to the three gardeners who were lying round the rose tree. For you see, as they were lying on their faces, and the pattern on their backs was the same as the rest of the pack, she could not tell whether they were gardeners, or soldiers, or courtiers, or three of her own children.
"How should I know?" said Alice, surprised at her own courage. "It's no business of mine."
The Queen turned crimson with fury, and after glaring at her for a moment like a wild beast, screamed, "Off with her head! Off!"
"Nonsense," said Alice, very loudly and decidedly, and the Queen was silent.
The King laid his hand upon her arm and timidly said, "Consider, my dear, she is only a child." The Queen turned angrily away from him and said to the Knave, "Turn them over." The Knave did so, very carefully with one foot.
"Get up," said the Queen, in a shrill, loud voice, and the three gardeners instantly jumped up and began bowing to the King, the Queen, the royal children, and everybody else.
"Leave off that," screamed the Queen. "You make me giddy." And then, turning to the rose tree, she went on, "What have you been doing here?"
"May it please your Majesty," said Two, in a very humble tone, going down on one knee as he spoke.
"We were trying..."
"I see," said the Queen, who had meanwhile been examining the roses.
"Off with their heads."
And the procession moved on, three of the soldiers remaining behind to execute the unfortunate gardeners, who ran to Alice for protection.
"You shan't be beheaded," said Alice, and she put them into a large flower pot that stood near.
The three soldiers wandered about for a minute or two, looking for them, and then quietly marched off after the others.
"Are their heads off?" shouted the Queen.
"Their heads are gone, if it please your Majesty," the soldiers shouted in reply.
"That's right," shouted the Queen. "Can you play croquet?"
The soldiers were silent and looked at Alice, as the question was evidently meant for her.
"Yes," shouted Alice. "Come on then," roared the Queen, and Alice joined the procession, wondering very much what would happen next.
It's a very fine day," said a timid voice at her side. She was walking by the White Rabbit, who was peeping anxiously into her face.
"Very," said Alice. "Where's the Duchess?"
"Hush, hush," said the Rabbit in a low, hurried tone. He looked anxiously over his shoulder as he spoke, and then raised himself upon tiptoe, put his mouth close to her ear, and whispered,
She's under sentence of execution.
What for? Said Alice.
Did you say, what a pity? The rabbit asked.
No, I didn't, said Alice. I don't think it's at all a pity. I said, what for?
She boxed the Queen's ears, the rabbit began.
Alice gave a little scream of laughter.
Oh, hush, the rabbit whispered in a frightened tone.
The Queen will hear you. You see, she came rather late, and the Queen said,
Get to your places, shouted the Queen in a voice of thunder.
People began running about in all directions, tumbling up against each other. They got settled down in a minute or two, and the game began. Alice thought she had never seen such a curious croquet ground in her life. It was all ridges and furrows. The balls were live hedgehogs, the mallets live flamingos, and the soldiers had to double themselves up and to stand on their hands and feet to make the arches. The chief difficulty Alice found at first was in managing her flamingo. She succeeded in getting its body tucked away comfortably enough under her arm, with its legs hanging down. But generally, just as she had got its neck nicely straightened out, and was going to give the hedgehog a blow with its head, it would twist itself round and look up in her face with such a puzzled expression that she could not help burst out laughing. And when she had got its head down and she was going to begin again, it was very provoking to find that the hedgehog had unrolled itself and was in the act of crawling away. Besides all this, there was generally a ridge or furrow in the way wherever she wanted to send the hedgehog to. And as the doubled-up soldiers were always getting up and walking off to other parts of the ground, Alice soon came to the conclusion that it was a very difficult game indeed. The players all played at once, without waiting for turns, quarrelling all the while, fighting for the hedgehogs. And in a very short time, the Queen was in a furious passion, and went stamping about and shouting, off with his head, or off with her head, about once in a minute. Alice began to feel very uneasy. To be sure, she had not as yet had any dispute with the Queen, but she knew that it might happen any minute. And then, thought she, what would become of me? They're dreadfully fond of beheading people here. The great wonder is, there's anyone left alive? She was looking about for some way of escape, wondering whether she could get away without being seen, when she noticed a curious appearance in the air. It puzzled her very much at first, but after watching it a minute or two, she made it out to be a grin, and she said to herself, It's the Cheshire Cat, and now I shall have somebody to talk to. How are you getting on? Said the cat, as soon as there was mouth enough for it to speak with. Alice waited till the eyes appeared, and then nodded. It's no use speaking to it, she thought, till its ears have come, or at least one of them. In another minute, the whole head appeared, and then Alice put down her flamingo and began an account of the game, feeling very glad she had someone to listen to her. The cat seemed to think that there was enough of it now in sight, and no more of it appeared. I don't think they play at all fairly, Alice began, in a rather complaining tone. And they all quarrel so dreadfully one can't hear oneself speak, and they don't seem to have any rules in particular. At least, if there are, nobody attends to them. And you've no idea how confusing it is, all the things being alive. For instance, there's the arch I've got to go through next, walking about at the other end of the ground. And I should have croqueted the Queen's hedgehog just now, only it ran away when it saw mine coming. How do you like the Queen? Said the cat in a low voice.
Not at all, said Alice.
She's so extremely... Just then she noticed that the Queen was close behind her, listening. So she went on, likely to win, that it's hardly worth finishing the game. The queen smiled and passed on. Who are you talking to? Said the king, going up to Alice and looking at the cat's head with great curiosity. It's a friend of mine, a Cheshire cat, said Alice. Allow me to introduce it. I don't like the look of it at all, said the king. However, it may kiss my hand if it likes. I'd rather not, the cat remarked. Don't be impertinent, said the king, and don't look at me like that. He got behind Alice as he spoke. A cat may look at a king, said Alice. I've read that in some book, but I don't remember where. Well, it must be removed, said the king very decidedly, and he called the queen, who was passing at the moment. My dear, I wish you would have this cat removed. The queen had only one way of settling all difficulties, great or small. Off with his head, she said, without even looking round. I'll fetch the executioner myself, said the king eagerly, and he hurried off. Alice thought she might as well go back and see how the game was going on, as she heard the queen's voice in the distance screaming with passion. She had already heard her sentence, three of the players to be executed for having missed their turns, and she did not like the look of things at all. The game was in such a confusion, she never knew whether it was her turn or not. So she went in search of her hedgehog. The hedgehog was engaged in a fight with another hedgehog, which seemed to Alice an excellent opportunity for croqueting one of them with the other. The only difficulty was, her flamingo was gone across to the other side of the garden, where Alice could see it trying in a helpless sort of way to fly up into a tree. By the time she had caught the flamingo and brought it back, the fight was over, and both the hedgehogs were out of sight. But it doesn't matter much, thought Alice, as all the arches are gone from this side of the ground. So she tucked it away under her arm, that it might not escape again, and went back for a little more conversation with her friend. When she got back to the Cheshire Cat, she was surprised to find quite a large crowd collected round it. There was a dispute going on between the executioner, the king, and the queen, who were all talking at once, while all the rest were quite silent and looked very uncomfortable. The moment Alice appeared, she was appealed to by all three to settle the question, and they repeated their arguments to her, though as they all spoke at once, she found it very hard indeed to make out exactly what they said. The executioner's argument was, you couldn't cut off a head unless there was a body to cut it off from, that he had never had to do such a thing before, and he wasn't going to begin at his time of life. The king's argument was that anything that had a head could be beheaded, and that you weren't to talk nonsense. The queen's argument was that if something wasn't done about it in less than no time, she'd have everybody executed all round. It was this last remark that had made the whole party look so grave and anxious. Alice could think of nothing else to say, but it belongs to the Duchess. You'd better ask her about it. She's in prison, the Queen said to the executioner. Fetch her here. And the executioner went off like an arrow. The cat's head began fading away the moment he was gone, and by the time he had come back with the Duchess, it had entirely disappeared. So the king and the executioner ran wildly up and down looking for it, while the rest of the party went back to
to the game. And that is where we close the book tonight. Thank you for joining me. I hope that you're enjoying Alice in Wonderland, and I will see you next time for even more readings. Until then, thank you, and good night.